Hello, everyone, and thanks for hanging out with us for the Behind the Numbers weekly listen. The Marketer podcast made possible by Mountain. This is the Friday show that reviews the most surprising media and retail news stories of the week. I'm your host, Marcus Johnson, in today's show. Out-of-home advertising's recovery.
I think that a lot of the dip was we weren't going to football stadiums, we weren't going to malls, we weren't going to a lot of places where traditional out-of-home and the more expensive out-of-home ads typically appear.
The cheapest and most expensive ad media.
When you see that, it really shows you how much further potentially these print institutions can fall when the premium for advertising is basically what's keeping them afloat.
Leasing a Peloton.
I think it's an interesting strategy and maybe a smart one, but I do think that consumers are experiencing or starting to experience subscription fatigue. I know I am.
Rethinking the gig worker model, an unpopular opinion about how we measure things, and a surprising turn of events for physical music sales. Join me for this episode. We have three people. Let's meet them. We start with our principal analyst who heads up our marketing practice. It's Dave Frankland.
Hey, Marcus. Great to be here.
Hey, fella. Thanks for hanging out. We're also joined by one of our senior analysts on the retail and e-commerce team. It's Blake Droche.
Hey, everyone.
Hey, friend. And finally, we have one of our directors of reports editing. It's Rahul Chadha.
Hey, Marcus. Thanks for having me.
Hey, buddy. So today, what do we have in store for you? Well, four segments as per usual. We start with the story of the week. We're talking out-of-home advertising's recovery. We move to the game of the week where our contestants, Blake, Rahul, and Dave will go head-to-head-to-head, give us the best takeaways they can from each of the four stories we have for you to win the championship belt. We then move to uncommon knowledge, where we've got some unpopular opinions to chew over. And finally, dinner party data. We'll talk about some random things we just recently learned. But we start, as always, with a story of the week. Out-of-home advertising's recovery. Out-of-home advertising revenue grew 38% in Q3 2021, year over year. I couldn't see Q4 numbers. I think they take a while to come out. This is according to the Out-of-Home Advertising Association of America. Digital was up 56%. The OAAA, as they're abbreviated, also found that nearly 90 of the top 100 out-of-home advertisers increased their out-of-home spend from Q3 2020 to Q3 2021, and half of the top 100 out-of-home advertisers more than doubled their spend. But despite the good Q3 numbers, insider intelligence analyst Daniel Konstantinovich notes that out-of-home ad spending, which fell 30% or $2.6 billion in 2020 as a result of the pandemic, will take years to crawl back toward pre-lockdown highs. U.S. out-of-home ad spend fell from $8.6 billion in 2019 to $6 billion in 2020. It jumped back up to nearly $7 billion the following year. So it goes 8.6, 6, 7. But it will inch back to $7.5 billion by 2025, which will still be a full $1 billion below the pre-pandemic figures. Gents, your thoughts on the current shape, current state of the out-of-home ad market in the US?
Yeah, I think those year-over-year growth figures are really reflective of everybody pulling back on out-of-home advertising in 2020. I don't think it's an endorsement of like how useful the medium is for advertisers. Mm. And I think the other part of out-of-home ads is that it's really hard to measure return on investment on these types of media. You know, I think there's been efforts to digitize. You referenced the growth in digital media, but you know, I think it makes it easier to change up the creative and replace it more quickly, but it does little to close the loop on attribution. I think that's the issue that out-of-home advertising is always going to struggle with.
You mentioned the huge drop in 2020, particularly in the summer, and Joe Mandis of Media Post was writing, it's the ultimate paradox for an ad medium because time spent with out-of-home media among Americans actually expanded during the 2020 COVID-19 pandemic. People were outside a lot more, but spending by U.S. advertisers fell, according to a lot of people, but in particular, PQ Media's annual digital out-of-home media forecast. The measurement piece is interesting. Do we think that out-of-home advertising will ever get to the point where it kind of lives up to the promise or to the potential? Because Laurie Sullivan of Media Post notes, Accretive Media, a programmatic digital out-of-home and mobile ad company, built a platform to measure out-of-home media and increase performance in partnership with a bunch of folks. And the CEO of that company, Craig Benner, notes that the behavior of consuming an out-of-home ad is very different than digital because the physical world has to consider a much more dynamic set of factors like screen location, orientation, size, bearing, direction, any potential obstructions, dwell time of consumer, speed of travel of consumer, movement patterns of consumer, and more. There's lots of different metrics that they could collect if we're able to measure it. I mean, it has a lot of potential, but do we think out-of-home advertising can ever live up to the promise?
Yeah, I think it's always been the less sexy medium. You know, there's some really cool examples of what people do, but a lot of it is just stuff people drive by. I think when you look at the digitization of it, there's some really cool stuff going on outside the US. A lot of 3D style billboards where it looks like things are actually jumping out of buildings and that sort of thing, especially over in Asia, parts of Europe. Coming to the measurement side, and you mentioned mobile, there was a huge movement in parts of Europe towards interactive out of home, where it could detect a mobile beacon and the ad would actually dynamically change based on what they knew about you. But with a lot of privacy concerns, some of that has gone away. So I think there has been some attempts at innovation, but like I say, it's been the least sexy for a while. But I just got off a plane in LAX and you walk through and there are a lot of billboards knocking around. I think a lot of the dip was we weren't going to football stadiums, we weren't going to malls, we weren't going to a lot of places where traditional out-of-home and the more expensive out-of-home ads typically appear.
David, do you remember any of the ads that you saw on the way from the airport?
Yeah,
to
except they were almost all for travel. You know, the irony of being in an airport and having just landed and they're all for travel. I think the best use case I've ever seen is actually the dueling auto manufacturers, where for a couple of years, especially some of the German manufacturers, BMW and Audi, had sort of, it was basically public banter going on between each other, where every day one of them would respond to the previous day's ads. That was actually out here in California, and some of it was just incredibly clever, really creative. But we know about it because it was covered in other media.
Right.
Anecdotally, I was on the subway the other day, and for the first time I saw the famous New York City subway banner ads that run at the top of the cars are now digital in a few cars. However, all of the ads in the entire car were just city ads encouraging folks to get the vaccine. So it doesn't look like they've really sold much inventory yet. But I do think that, that is something that is new from out of home that maybe the city took advantage of the lull in ridership to install a few of these things and start testing them. But I think largely when we talked about out of home, especially digital out of home, it was always a piece of larger campaigns. And maybe during the pandemic, a lot of campaigns were adjusted and launched to not include this piece. And maybe advertisers just realized that it wasn't as integral of a part of the campaign now having experimented, not using it, or just deciding going forward, at least in the short term, that it's just, not really as important of a piece. And that's why the recovery is going to be slower.
Yeah, digital out of home, according to our numbers, makes up 1/3 of total out of home ads. It will grow to about 40% in the next 4 or 5 years. Growth, though, falls to single digits from 2023. So it's at 29% last year, it'll be 18% this year, and it falls to single-digit growth for digital out-of-home ad spends from next year onwards. So it has slowed down considerably. In terms of where people are placing the ads, from Q3 2020 to Q3 2021, the share that out-of-home advertisers spent on place-based and street furniture went up to the slight detriment of billboards. But billboards still account for 76% of overall out-of-home ad spending. Street furniture was now up to 6% as of Q3 last year, and place-based was at 5%, according to the OAAA. In terms of cool examples, let's finish with a couple from Adweek contributor Kenyatta Collins. Recently put together a list of the 15 campaigns honored in Adweek's 2021 Out-of-Home Impact Awards. A couple here, guys. Varo Bank, they had a Bank for All of Us campaign where they placed customers' portraits in the center of giant US currency images. So it looked like you were on the money, dotted around billboards on the sides of buses, things like that. And then Subaru, they had a Wilderness Outback. They had a campaign, Set It Free, where they placed animal crates that were about the size of an SUV in key metro areas. And there were roaring noises coming from the box. I think it would also shake a bit. And passersby were encouraged to scan the QR code on the crate to book a test drive and set free the new vehicle. Aside from Dave's recent experience walking through the airport, any campaigns that you guys either saw in this list or that have jumped out in your kind of personal lives walking around?
Well, during the pandemic, The state of Ohio put up big billboards along the West Side Highway encouraging New Yorkers who were disgruntled by the restriction during the lockdown to move to Ohio. So I thought that was pretty clever. However, I will say it did not sway me to move to Ohio. I'm still here.
Yeah, Blake's now based in Cleveland.
Well, I was going to say, just leaning back on what Blake said about the subways, and it reminded me of the movie, if anyone saw Tick, Tick, Boom, which is a movie about the life of Jonathan Larson, who wrote Rent. And there's a scene on it where they are on the subway, and in the background you see the ads for Dr. Z. Anyone who lived in New York in the 90s, they were ubiquitous on every, I see Rahul laughing, on every subway you got onto. And so we do notice them, and I thought it was a really nice touch that they'd gone back and found some of those ads to put in the background. So it was a little nostalgia kick, but also a nod to the continuity folks who worked on the movie.
Yeah, I remember those, even just visiting New York as a kid. couple of little cool ones. Barclays Bank, Delaware. The flight is right. People could spin a giant wheel and win prizes. And then Mini, they redesigned a bus and parked one of their cars on the bus, a double-decker bus at the bottom level, and drove it around the city, the bus around the city, to prove that you can literally park a Mini anywhere. Anyway, that's all we've got time for the story of the week. Time now for the game of the week. First, quick word from our sponsor, Mountain. If you could combine the precision targeting of digital advertising with the impact of television commercials, you would have an incredibly effective ad channel. That's exactly what Mountain Performance TV does. Their connected TV software platform allows advertisers to reach their ideal audiences and drive more visits, conversions, and revenue, all from a single intuitive solution that's optimized to deliver performance. Visit mountain.com to learn more. Right, folks, we are back. It's time now for the game of the week. Today's game, what's the point? Where we read out four stories and have contestants Rahul, Blake, and Dave tell us what they think is the main takeaway of the story. Okay, answers get 1 point. Good answers get two. And answers that give you the same feeling as when you're waiting for a Polaroid to develop, and then it does, and it's perfect. Answers that leave you with that feeling, they get you 3 points. Each person gets 20 seconds to answer before they hear this. Whoever has the most points wins gets the last word. We start with Rahul. What people watch on TV. Sports maintains control of TV watch time, writes John Casillo of TV Rev. He notes that with a mostly normal TV schedule in 2021, audiences moved back into old viewership habits, watching tons of sports-related TV, as data from Vizio recently showed. The NFL accounted for the most watch time with 2.7% of the total. College football was a distant second with 1.3%. With about 0.7 to 0.8%, the rest of the top 10 went Law & Order Special Victims Unit in third, NBA, Good Morning America, SportsCenter, the 2020 Tokyo Olympics, Today Friends, and Chicago PD in 10th. But Rahul, what people watch on TV, what's the point?
Yeah, this actually just made me think about how all the SVODs, the subscription-based video on demand services, are really fighting over sports live streaming rights now. I think the narrative a couple years ago is that people are going to stick with live TV for live events like sports and maybe news and something like the Olympics or something like that. And I think now with entities like Amazon Prime nabbing Thursday Night Football rights and Apple's recent Major League Baseball deal, this information just made me think how important it is for the SVODs to kind of keep doubling down on landing these sports rights.
Blake?
Yeah, I'd be interested in seeing this data paired up against time that is spent streaming, so nonlinear content, because that does, seem really promising for sports. But then when you look at sort of the lion's share here of TV shows that people are watching, I would imagine that the rest is like extremely minuscule compared to this content or other similar, scripted television or sitcom content that is being streamed on platforms like Netflix and Hulu, et cetera.
Dave.
Sports and established franchises are keeping linear alive. We've known it for a while. I think we'll continue to see a steady decline as the streaming companies continue to capture more and as we spend on them and we get cord cutting. I just think we are where we are they're doing just fine. It's where some of these big shows are, the Olympics, the Super Bowl. The other thing I would throw in is it's interesting how many people were going to boycott the NFL from a political point of view, and yet they're still top of the pile.
Yeah, speaking top of the pile, I mean, one of the other stats from this was, in all, sports make up 8 of the top 30 programs by watch time and 6 of the top 11. The data from Vizio Inscape indicating NFL games accounted for 20% of sports-related watch time on the year, college football 10, NBA games made up 6% of sports minutes watched, and SportsCenter 5, Olympics had just under 5. And also, I thought it was fascinating because the MLB was just outside the top 10 in 11th, but there are 2,500 regular season MLB games. There's 9 times more than there are NFL games, potential games that they could watch. So just the power of the NFL is just incredible. We move to our second round. We start with Blake, the cheapest and most expensive ad media. With median CPMs in the $2 range, digital display and out-of-home transit shelter ads are the most cost-efficient of any major ad media, according to the Out-of-Home Advertising Association of America, which we talked about in the first segment. The recent analysis conducted by financial advisory firm Solomon Partners in January of this year, 2022, reveals a remarkable range of advertising costs within mediums, writes Joe Mandis of MediaPost. With a median CPM of $47, print newspaper ads are the most expensive medium overall, according to the analysis, followed by primetime broadcast TV's medium CPM of $36. But Blake, the cheapest and most expensive ad media, what's the point?
The point is that I have a special place in my heart, I think, for a lot of writers and, you know, and journalism enthusiasts for print media. But when you see that, it really shows you how much further potentially these print institutions can fall when the premium for advertising is basically what's keeping them afloat, and they can, they're very reliant on a smaller and smaller subset of advertisers who are willing to pay those steep fees. And I think, you know, if those go away, then unfortunately it's going to be even harder on some of our favorite journalistic institutions that still put out print content.
Dave.
I think a lot of CMOs and media buyers are, to be polite, I'll say, focused on legacy, and you could also say old-fashioned and out of date. Depending on the audience they're chasing, they're spending money where their audience isn't, because that's where they grew up, and I think that's going to continue to shift.
Rahul?
I don't think it's a surprise that an entity called the Out-of-Home Advertising of Association of America, do they call themselves OHA? Sorry, found that out-of-home ads are the most cost-effective. You know, they might be the cheapest, but that doesn't mean they're effective, I don't think. And then just to Blake's point, you know, that's an interesting idea. I wonder if the fact that the CPMs for newspapers are so high is more reflective of declining circulation than the fact that they're actually charging a premium anymore. But yeah, I think if out-of-home advertising is as effective as OHA would want it to be, then you would have seen a bunch of D2Cs funneling all their marketing money into out-of-home ads instead of social media a few years ago.
We move to our third round. We start with Dave, leasing a Peloton. Peloton's testing a leasing program for its bike, writes Victoria Song of The Verge. She notes that the new One Peloton Club bundles the cost of the bike and classes in a single monthly fee, starting in select states from March 11th. Those states are Texas, Florida, Minnesota, and Colorado. Customers will pay a single $60 to $100 monthly fee that covers renting the bike and the cost of the classes, according to the Wall Street Journal. If the customer decides to cancel, Peloton will take the bike back free of charge. But Dave, leasing a Peloton, what's the point?
Makes perfect sense. I get the hardware, the software, and when it becomes a clothes rack, I send it back.
Boom. It's a true story. Rahul.
I think it's an interesting strategy and maybe a smart one, but I do think that consumers are experiencing or starting to experience subscription fatigue. I know I am, but it does sound like the CEO is willing to try an experiment and fail approach to find a path back to profitability for Peloton.
Blake.
Yeah, I think we're just seeing that during the pandemic, there was sort of this one size fits all approach to home workout equipment. But given the fact that we all sort of live in this hybrid world now, which extends beyond just work, but also to the way that people do things like exercise, that more flexibility in any type of business model can't really be a bad thing right now.
Yeah. The new Peloton CEO, Barry McCarthy, that Rahul had just referenced, was previously the CFO of Spotify and Netflix, so his experience with subscriptions was a major reason he was brought on. And this isn't the only move Peloton's made to attract new customers. They also just recently extended their free at-home trial from 30 to 100 days for a limited period. We move to our final round. We start with Rahul rethinking the gig worker model. Instead of offering gig work to contractors who pick up and fill grocery orders, Amazon is shifting those gig workers into jobs as Whole Foods employees, Whole Foods, which it owns, according to a letter to employees reported by CNBC, writes Insider Intelligence senior analyst Zach Stambor. The transition will be complete by year end. But Rahul, rethinking the gig worker model, what's the point?
I think we're seeing that market forces are dictating that companies end this kind of gig worker model, and they have to bring these people into the fold if they want some kind of regular dependence on their labor force. You know, the article made the point that workers have been absorbing the employer's business costs, I think, and the math doesn't work anymore when you look at gas prices for Uber drivers or something like that. And I do think that, you know, I think the talking point these companies always repeat is that workers like flexibility, but you know what else workers like is a guaranteed paycheck, a regularity in the size and cadence of the money that's coming in.
Blake.
Yeah, I agree completely with Rahul. I mean, as these businesses become more mature, it sort of seems like that's the only route that they can go without having, you know, the massive turnover, constant conflict with the people that generally power their businesses. And I don't think that new startups can really move into really mature, sustainable companies unless they have some sort of, you know, mutual understanding with how you're, you know, going to be treated and the benefit and the just basic description of the large bulk of the employers that they have that really do the grunt work for these organizations.
Dave.
It's interesting that Amazon is the company that's referenced. They are masters at turning their cost centers into business success. From AWS to delivery, there's a whole host of examples of where Amazon has turned their costs into competitive advantage. And I think people is the next frontier. I think they've realized they've done it from the pandemic point of view. They're insisting on, they were one of the first to insist on vaccination. So their employees have seen those benefits. You know, they get a lot of negative press for how they treat their employees. So it'll be interesting to see how this shakes out. They've sort of surfed the line in the past between public sentiment and just before things switch a certain way from a legal point of view, they switch. They did it with delivery tax, etc. And so I think this is the same thing. I think hammer is going to come down on the gig economy, and they want to get ahead of it.
Quickly back to Rahul's point about gig workers liking flexibility. And I've spoken to a couple of them just anecdotally, and they do say that. They do say we like the flexibility of being able to work when we want. However, Zach Stambor, who wrote this article we previously referenced, was noting that, quote, one significant issue facing companies that use gig workers is that 6 in 10 would prefer permanent employment, according to a 2021 survey by McKinsey and Ipsos. So at least according to this survey, it suggests that most of them actually do want a permanent position.
I think you can have flexibility and permanence. You know, those two things I think we've looked on as mutually exclusive in the past. I think we've come to a lot of companies have come to the realization that you can now offer, you need to offer both.
Yeah, it's true. So we've got time for the game of the week. This week's winner, a drum roll. Rahul is this week's winner of the game of the week. Congratulations to him. He gets the championship belt and the last word. Rahul, what do you want to tell us?
Oh, I just want to shout out the place I've been taking guitar classes, Mr. John's Music in Philadelphia. Excellent. I love my teacher. He's amazing. If you're in Philly and interested in taking guitar classes, check him out.
Very good. How's it going?
It's going pretty good. I kind of can do bar chords now. I'm very happy. Very pleased with myself. I thought it was never going to happen.
Can we put in some of your music as the... to end the show, Victoria,
we should do.
Rahul, get your guitar. Get your guitar.
It can be a toss up. We can play my music and then people strangling cats, and people have to decide which is which. That should be the giveaway.
Well, congratulations on the guitar, but also on winning the game of the week. You get the pretend championship belt, at least until next week. We move now to uncommon knowledge. Well, this is the segment where we offer up some unpopular or atypical opinions about things. We start with an unpopular opinion from the BBC Radio 1 feature. This was inspired by, and then an unpopular opinion from the internet. And finally, we get an unpopular opinion from one of the analysts related to the media world. We start with an unpopular opinion from the BBC Radio 1 show. This week, there is nothing special about sushi. It's just fish and rice, a bit of seaweed, and some wasabi, also known as food of the devil. What do you feel about this person has some opinions. Well, what do we think? I don't mind sushi.
I like sushi. I don't need the seaweed. That assumes you're jumping to a role, which tells me you're not very sophisticated, which tells me your opinion doesn't matter. Not you, of course, Marcus, the person who gave this
opinion. Thank you. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Yeah, I think that this whoever has that opinion doesn't know how to enjoy the simple things in life. I mean, a beautiful piece of fresh fish. I mean, you could pass that off, but I mean, what in life is better than a nice piece of fresh fish? Come on.
That is a true unpopular opinion. It holds no purchase with me.
All right, moving on. This one's from the internet. What is the point of Ed Sheeran?
I've got to agree with that. I've never really Ed Sheeran song I've heard has ever really gripped me, even though I hear he's very popular in the UK.
His early stuff was awesome. I think his current stuff, he sounds like everybody else. Every new song that comes out, my kids and I are trying to figure out whether it's him or your man from Canada that has the tattoos, whose name I can't remember.
Biebs?
Yeah. They sound exactly the same to this point.
Well, so ironically, or coincidentally, one of them. Ed Sheeran, he draws 77 million listeners a month on Spotify. That's more than any other artist except Justin Bieber. And Ed Sheeran's 2017 song Shape of You is Spotify's biggest hit ever, with nearly 3 billion streams worldwide, according to the New York Times. I don't mind him.
Sorry, yeah, my favorite thing about Ed Sheeran is how incongruous his appearance is with his music. I don't know that much of his music, but whenever I see him with his shirt off, I'm like, oh, this is the same guy who's making all that poppy music.
That's him.
I'll also say, if you haven't seen Yesterday, the movie about the Beatles, he's in it playing himself. And I think he was both really, really good and did not take himself too seriously at all. So worth checking out.
Okay, very good. That's called what?
Wasn't it Yesterday, I think?
Yeah. Okay, very good. All right, that's enough Ed Sheeran talk. I've got one for you this week. So it's from our analyst, but it's from me. This is my unpopular opinion. One of many. So I think we need to measure the world in more modern ways. And so what I mean by that is, so GDP is the most commonly used measure of economic activity. It measures the total goods and services produced in a nation in a given time period. Everyone knows that. The equation of GDP is GDP equals private consumption plus gross private investment plus government investment plus government spending plus exports minus imports. First basic concept of GDP was invented at the end of the 18th century. The modern concept was developed by the Russian-born but American economist Simon Kuznets in 1934 and adopted as the main measure of a country's economy. But as a really great economist piece recently pointed out, it's an increasingly poor measure of prosperity. It is not even a reliable gauge of production, especially in economies well past farms and production lines. Nobel Prize winning economist Joseph Stiglitz has called for an end to the GDP obsession. Since today's rich economy is dominated by made-to-order services and are increasingly geared to the quality of the experience rather than the production of ever more stuff, the trickiness is raised to a higher level. The Economist article was explaining that these days it seems that a growing fraction of innovation is not measured at all. In a world where houses are Airbnb hotels and private cars are Uber taxis, where a free software upgrade renews old computers and Facebook and YouTube bring hours of daily entertainment to hundreds of millions of people at no price at all, many suspect GDP is becoming an ever more misleading measure. And so to link this back to the media world, I mean, it's kind of linked just from a business standpoint, but I just feel like we're putting too much emphasis on top line user growth figures. And every quarter we go through the earnings and we say, this is the total millions. And we scrutinize, went up by a few million or down or whatever. And we look at revenue as well. And there's a few other things in there, but I just think there's too much emphasis on top line user growth figures. And we need to think more about other engagement metrics, time spent, completion rates, daily, not monthly active users, activities conducted on the platform, things like that. Thoughts?
What do we replace it with?
So there is a GDP 2.0. Maybe on next week's episode, I'll explain more about that. But it's just other, I mean, one of the indicators is...
Tune in next week for Economics with Marcus. Sorry.
Yeah, I know. On next week's show. But even simple things like some countries now have like a happiness index.
Mm-hmm.
So things like that or time off or how much maternity leave does a country offer? More like kind of quality of life measures.
So I think you see that in country rankings, you know, when
magazines
and that sort of thing will do best places to live and that sort of thing.
Education
GDP is
rankings.
One of those factors, right?
But yes.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's an awful lot of things that are completely out of date in how we run the world today. It's funny when you said, you know, how we measure things need to change. I thought you were going to say that everyone should use the metric system, and I was going to agree with you.
Well, that's true. Yeah, that's true. Let's start with GDP, and then we'll move on to getting rid of Fahrenheit. Bloody hell, America. Get it together. All right. Feel like I nailed this one. So final little passage from the Economist. It's such a great article. It's basically saying the benefits of many new products are simply not picked up at all. The upfront costs of providing services on a digital platform like Facebook or Twitter are hefty, but the marginal costs are close to zero, and the explicit price to users is normally nothing. By global convention, zero-priced goods are excluded from GDP. So are all voluntary forms of digital production, such as Wikipedia and open source computer programs. Some of this unpaid for activity can be picked up in the accounting, although there is no charge for a Google search. Consumers pay a shadow price by supplying information and attention, for which advertisers pay, but the advertising revenue is likely to be well below the benefits that consumers get.
I think that whatever country has the longest life expectancy is just de facto the best country.
Who is that?
I think it's
Bhutan?
It's always like some country that you wouldn't expect, but I mean, you've got to think that if the life expectancy is long, then they're clearly prosperous enough to have a solid healthcare system, the access to good food and medicine, and generally in countries that are sort of maybe rely too much on the whole narrative of like what the GDP is, like the country that, you know, I'm from and live in, is that the life expectancy is not as long, even though we do, you know, produce the most goods and are arguably more innovative than other countries. But the life expectancy is getting a lot shorter, and for a lot of grim reasons, like mental health and drug use and suicide and overall physical health, obesity and things like that. So I think at a really simple level, you could just go, look at the life expectancy, and who doesn't want to live in the country where you're more likely to live the longest? Seems pretty simple.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. According to a quick Google search, worldometers, they have Hong Kong, Japan, Macau, 85 years on average. Women a couple of years more, men a couple of years less. It's not looking good, America. It's not looking good at all. 46th place, 79 years. Still pretty long. But it's not very high in the rankings. But yeah, different measures, I think. Different measures. Anyway, so we've got time for Uncommon Knowledge. It's time now for Dinner Party Data. This is the part of the show where we tell you about the most interesting thing that we've learned this week. We start with Rahul because he won the game of the week. Rahul, what you got for us?
So in honor of National Women's History Month, dug up some information. According to Swedish loan company Advisa, only 15% of banknotes worldwide feature women. Sweden and Australia both have four that feature women more than any other country. The U.S. only has one instance of a woman featured on a banknote, and that was Martha Washington, who appeared on a $1 silver certificate sometime in the 19th century. And so now there's like an effort underway to get Harriet Tubman on the $20 bill, but the launch of that bill is not expected until 2030 due to some anti-counterfeiting requirements and some other bureaucratic bogs that I probably know nothing about.
Yeah, I did see that research quickly. I think Visual Capitalist had a piece on it.
Yeah.
All the different countries. Yeah, well, I guess it was citing that same. Yeah, it's absolutely fascinating. Yeah. All right. Blake, what you got for us?
Let's all take a guess. So people who currently watch Jeopardy on a regular basis, how old do you think they are on average?
2,000 years old.
I want to say like 55, like maybe into the, you know, the boomer ranges, but I feel like you're going to say it's Gen Z or something.
Yeah,
like
I was going to say, just because you're asking, I'm going to say it's 19.
So according to Civic Science ran a poll in February about, you know, the demographics of people who are frequent Jeopardy watchers. And yeah, you're right. So 18 to 34 year olds are actually the age group that are most likely to say that they watch Jeopardy on a regular basis. And they goes on to look at a little bit more of these. And basically the theme of this article is that the average Jeopardy watcher is not the demographic that anybody's expecting, which we all think are probably 55 plus, but you're, you know, more likely to be young people. Republicans slightly more likely to be regular Jeopardy watchers compared to Democrats. I mean, granted, it's only 16% versus 15%, so there's a margin for error. People who frequently use cannabis are more likely to be frequent Jeopardy watchers, and people who use online sports betting platforms are also more likely to be current Jeopardy watchers. So I don't know. I think if you're advertising, because when I watch Jeopardy, it's a whole lot of advertisements geared towards old folks, primarily pharmaceutical, but maybe, you know, TikTok and those, you know, LED lights for your bedroom companies need to start advertising on Jeopardy. So I think we need to pay a little bit more attention to the demographics as advertisers.
What's the intersection of that Venn diagram? Is it a Gen Z Republican dope smoking? I'm missing something.
Online sports better.
Degenerate gambler. Okay, we got
it.
It's a niche. Very good. Dave, what you got for us?
So in the interest of continuing, starting with a question, what do the telephone, the dishwasher, and the zipper have in common?
Telephone, the dishwasher.
All invented on a Tuesday.
All invented in England. No, Scotland.
All introduced at the World's Fair, or a World's Fair. So, nice. Some really cool stuff was introduced back in the day in World's Fairs. Air conditioning, coffee percolator, x-ray machine. Everyone probably knows Ferris wheel, so I didn't mention it. And then they even lay claim to things like ice cream cones, hot dogs, and theme parks, depending on the article you read.
Very nice. I've got one for you real quick. CD sales grew for the first time since 2004, is according to the Recording Industry Association of America. CD sales reached $584 million. That's $100 million more than 2020. 2021 vinyl sales are also up. They increased to $1 billion from $644 million the previous year. So vinyl went from $644 to $1 billion, and CDs went from basically just under $500 million to just under $600 million from 2020 to 2021. So if you combined the CD sales uptick with the decade-long vinyl sales explosion, overall physical music sales grew for the first time since 1996, if you include vinyl plus CDs. It's just CDs. It's the first time since 2004. According to Nate Rao, author of Axios Nashville, one local record store owner thinks this is about young people who are finding they like hard copies of music in the digital age. The CD was the music industry's leading format in the 1990s, as we all know, peaking at $13 billion in annual sales in 2000. Since then, it's been a staircase down to the point where CD music sales are just 4% the size of what they were in 2000. They're 4% the size they were at their peak in 2000 at $13 billion. Streaming, by contrast, now accounts for close to $9 billion in annual revenue.
That's like interesting to me because I've actually been on the hunt for CDs. The only CD player I have remaining is in my car, and I've been doing a lot more driving. And I've been hunting down used CDs, and I was kind of surprised how much they're trying to charge for them, like $3 or $4. I thought I'd be getting them for $1, but I guess I have these like kids to blame, huh?
I think it's very similar to how like baseball cards are making a comeback. I think collecting is becoming more of a thing now, and I see when a lot of popular artists, or not maybe not popular artists, but a lot of artists who are current release projects, there are people who are super fans of the genre that are looking to buy physical copies. I mean, there are a lot of hip hop artists that I follow that have come out with albums recently, and you go to their website and they're selling vinyl, obviously, but they're also selling CDs and cassettes, and they're, you know, being produced in limited quantities because they're being geared towards collectors, but they're selling out.
Yeah. Yeah, go to a fair amount of music shows, and a lot of the local artists at those shows, they sell merch to make some money to kind of continue to do what they're doing, playing music, semi or sometimes as full-time if they can. And a big part of that merch is like selling CDs or vinyl. And you can kind of see on their face when they're like, I've got CDs for sale. And you see these blank looks of people like, what the hell am I supposed to play that? And you can tell that they want something. They want to create something where they can sell that's physical to give out that's part of their music, not just t-shirts or stickers or what have you. So it does seem to be a bit of a conflict there in terms of what they want to sell physical music-wise and people's ability to play that said physical music.
The vinyl makes a lot of sense to me. CD less so. Like, I mean, you're basically playing a digital song if you're going to do that. Why wouldn't you stream? But
yeah,
it's interesting.
Quality-wise, yeah.
I thought they were buying them to use them as signaling mirrors.
They double up. That's all we've got time for today's episode. Thank you to my guests. A thank you to Dave.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you to Blake.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Of course. Thank you to Rahul.
Thanks, guys.
This week's winner of the game of the week. Thank you to Victoria. She edits the show. Thanks to everyone listening. To ask us questions or just say hi, you can email us at podcast@emarketer.com. We'll see you guys on Monday for the Behind the Numbers Daily, the eMarketer podcast made possible by Mountain. Happy weekends.